Thank you for joining us today. Our prayer is that your life will be touched by the Spirit of Almighty God with constant and powerful truths that can be applied to your everyday life.
Turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11 and hold your place. I'm doing one of those deals. And go to Exodus 4. I'm excited to get to share with you guys here this morning. Been thinking about this for a little while now. And Pastor's been preaching the last couple of Sundays on getting involved in the church. There are a lot of people in here who are involved, but two Sundays ago, he talked about the different stages of Christianity. If you did not get a chance to hear that, you should go back and listen to that, because it's really foundational to who we are as a church, to where our maturity level as a church. There are people that are receivers who, when you first get saved, you're just receiving, and everything is you're wide-eyed, you're in awe, you're amazed at the difference. Depending on how old you were when you got saved, if you can think back to that time, and you just trying to take it all in. I don't know if you can remember that time. It's like trying to drink from a fire hydrant when things just are so new and so real. But then there's the stage right after that called the transitioning stage, where you've heard a lot and you've been there a while, and I found that this transitioning stage comes up over and over and over again in different areas of your life, where you thought you had stuff down, you thought you had it all worked out, and then a new area pops up and a new part of your flesh comes out that you didn't know was there, and life is, it's transitioning. You're trying to work your way into the right thoughts instead of, I don't know what to make of all this. But if you stay hooked up and you stay with it and you don't give up, you make it to the third stage, and that is the transformed stage, to where you are now the giver, and you come to church, and you are looking for who you can give into. And he went over that extensively, and I loved it when I got to hear it at Ministries Conference, and I loved, I got to listen to it on podcast. I was sick on that Sunday, two Sundays ago, it's just, there's a difference coming into church and being ready to give than coming in and hoping somebody will give you something. It's a different idea. And then last week he talked about saying yes to different areas in the church and serving in different areas. And we passed out little cards for you guys to look at different areas that you could serve in. And I want to kind of continue along those two. He asked me to kind of continue with that idea for this Sunday morning. And I want to, all of these are areas of ministry that we talked about. We've got the welcome team, and we've got the parking team, and the security team, and we've got the coffee shop, and we've got different Sunday morning classes that you can be a part of. And there's just a slew of things that you can be a part of and really make an impact here at this church. And so this morning, I want to share on four lessons in ministering. Four lessons in ministering. He said 2 weeks ago that when we say ministering, lots of times we think of the idea of a pastor or a teacher or somebody who's up here on stage. But can I just tell you that the people that made the biggest impact in my life growing up were not the people that were on stage. They just weren't. I can name 4 out of 5 people in my 12 years of schooling, 13 years of schooling there, and most of them were people who were lower on the totem pole in our flesh. So we see different hierarchies inside the church. They were just people, men that loved the young men at the church there, men who gave of their time to teach at a kids' church in a certain, I guess we had, what was it, Royal Rangers. Anybody remember Royal Rangers? Buckaroos? I was a buckaroo, and what, yeah, different. I don't know why it was cowboy themed. The curriculum itself, I mean, this was in the late 80s, early 90s. The curriculum itself was probably 40 years old at that time. But it was the coolest thing in the world, because the men that served in that, I wanted to be like them. It's awesome what God uses. And we think, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Ministry can happen through you. That's what I want to say. Ministry can happen through you if you'll allow God to take you into that transformed stage of, I'm going to be a giver. Ministry can happen through you, and I mean you. Not somebody else sitting next to you, not somebody who speaks better than you, not somebody who's been in the church longer than you, through you. God uses us. There are lots of examples of people that we have in history of people ministering, especially in the Old Testament. Tons and tons of examples of people out of history. And you know, in the Old Testament, something they all had in common? They were all flawed. Every single one of them. Now we look at them in awe, and when we get there and see a little bit of Hebrews 11, you guys have hopefully all read that there. If you haven't, it's kind of like a glorious chapter of these are the people and this is what they did. But when you go back and read the history of those people, some of the stuff they did is just ridiculous. You're like, why in the world would you do some of those things? Moses is a perfect example, very good example. That's where Exodus 4. Moses, hopefully you know the story. If not, and you don't like reading, you can watch the Prince of Egypt movie from 20 years ago. I know a lot of people don't like reading. But Moses was born at a time in Egypt when all of the boys born to the Israelites were supposed to be killed. And the story itself is just too funny because the midwives who are helping out these Israelite women have their kids. They're like, they go back. Pharaoh says, why aren't you killing these babies? They're like, well, we don't know. They have the babies so fast and they're gone. We just can't keep up. And they're just gone. They're just already out there. And I was like, what kind of Pharaoh would believe that story? Like, these Israelites are just strong women. They just have the kids. They're gone and all the kids are gone. I don't know what happened to them. But Pharaoh, the Old Testament is great. If you haven't been reading the Old Testament recently, read the Old Testament. But anyway, Moses grows up with Pharaoh in the palace and sees his people getting mistreated and abused and decides that he's going to help one of them by murdering one of the slave drivers, one of the soldiers that are there, and because he's abusing one of his people, and so he kills him and buries his body in the sand and thinks nobody, it said he looked all around to make sure nobody was watching you, because that's what you do. If, young people, we know when you're about to do something wrong. Those of you who are real young who still think that you can get away with stuff, because what you do is every time before you're about to do something wrong, you look around to see if anybody's looking. You reach into the cookie jar when you know you're not supposed to, or you're going to have, well, nobody knows. Parents know. And it's fun being on the other side of that. The giving side of that as a parent is much better than the receiving end of my parents catching me. But he comes back the next day and he sees some Israelites fighting amongst themselves, and they're like, what are you going to do? You're going to kill us like you killed that Egyptian? And he's like, oh no, that feeling. I didn't make. And so he ran away. The story had gotten around already. I don't know if you know this or not, but people talk about other people. Anybody know that? Anybody had a conversation about somebody recently? It's what people do. And so he ran away because he was in the palace and he killed one of the people that were Egyptians. I mean, he's basically like a cop killer in today's terms. Like, I killed a cop. You know, everybody knows in any criminal show that you watch, you don't ever kill a cop because all the cops are going to come get you. He ran. He took off and he left, and I'm not going to be a part of this. I'm not going to have, and he ran away for 40 years. It was a long time. When God found him and called him out in the desert, and you've got the story of the burning bush, and it's cool. But as we look here in chapter 4, verse 1, God gets done telling him all the cool stuff that he's going to go do, and Moses protests. Verse 1, chapter 4. Moses protested again. What if they won't believe me or listen to me? What if they say, the Lord never appeared to you? And the Lord asked him, what is that in your hand? And he goes through and gives them these different miracles. He turns a staff into a snake. He puts his hand inside of his shirt and brings it out, and it comes out leprous, all white and like skin falling off, nasty, and then puts it back in and goes clear. And then he says, hey, if they don't believe those two, then you can pour some water out on the ground. When it hits the ground, it'll turn to blood. I'm like, that's okay. That, I mean, if somebody came up and did those three things in front of me, I'd probably still be skeptical, just my personality. But at the same time, I mean, he said, I heard from God. So then he has down here in verse 10, Moses pleaded with the Lord after those signs. He said, oh, Lord, I'm not very good with words. Or I imagine he said, oh, Lord, I'm not very good with words. I don't know if he changed the rest of the time. I don't know if he stuttered. I don't know what he meant by I'm not very good with words. This sentence seems fine to me. I never have been. And I'm not now, even though you have spoken to me. I get tongue-tied and my words get tangled. I get tongue-tangled and my words get tied. I don't know how he said it. I don't know how it came across. I being somebody that has been up here and spoken in front of this church and at other churches, and I very often get people coming up to me afterwards saying, well, I couldn't get up there and speak. Like, I'm talking to you now is my thought, because I was the person who could not get up there. I was the one who said I couldn't get up there and speak if you wanted me to. I'm not very good with words. I don't know how to talk. I'm too insecure to say anything. I don't know what to do. People come up, I don't know why people want to share that with me afterwards, but very often when you're a speaker, you get people coming to you and saying, oh, I could never do that. It's not any different than what you're doing in that conversation. You just think it through on the front end as best you can. You sometimes still get tongue-tied when you're up here and you still make mistakes, but I couldn't speak to anybody really. I couldn't talk to anybody. If you went to the church, we were in Kansas City this weekend, yesterday actually. We took a whirlwind trip up to Kansas City to see my mother-in-law and her husband, who he'd gotten diagnosed with cancer, and we wanted to go up and just see him, talk to him, love on him a little bit. And we took our kids around, driving around Kansas City to show them, hey, this right here is the church where Cynthia and I met. And they're like, what do you mean when you met? And I was like, well, when we knew each other, for we first met each other, it was at this church right here. And they're like, I don't get it. What do you mean? Like, there was a time when you didn't know each other? You kind of threw them off. But if you'd gone to that church, you probably wouldn't know me. I don't know how I met my wife. I don't know, because it was like God just walked her by me, and I was like, oh, it was like, it was, but she probably didn't see me the first time, and probably I could not look anybody in the eye. I thought I was terrible with words. I thought that I couldn't, I was no good. My perception of myself was wrong, just like Moses. He was insecure. Throw your staff on the ground. And he throws it on the ground and picks it up by the tail, picks the snake up by the tail, turns back into a staff. And he's like, oh, Lord, that won't work. That's not going to work. I don't know how that's going to happen. But here's the thing. He finally negotiated to have Aaron be his spokesman, and that didn't really turn out too good a few times. But Moses was obedient, and he did spend a lot of time with the Lord. And the Bible says that he got to actually see God, like literally see God. Like God got him up here on this mountain, and he said, I'm going to put my hand over you, and you're not going to be able to see, and I'm going to walk past you because nobody can look at the front of me, my face or anything, but you can look at my backside as I walk away. I don't know what the difference is when you're a spirit, but he literally got to see God. He was in his presence all the time. Moses went somewhere because he was obedient. This morning, I want to share with you four lessons in ministering, and the first one is this. Don't stay in your comfort zone. Because when God called Moses to go do something, when he gave him his ministry, what he was supposed to do, his ministry was to go back to the people on one side that he had murdered and on the other side that had been calling him a murderer. It's not very comfortable. Now, it had been 40 years, and it said that the people that wanted to kill you were all dead. And thank you for that bit of information, Lord. The people who wanted to kill me are all dead. So, I'll go back. In serving and ministering in the church, you're going to have to get outside of your comfort zone. If you don't talk to the people around you, you're not going to know the people around you. You show love to people by finding out about them. You show love to people by getting involved in their life. And if you want to be someone who's seen as somebody who serves the Lord, somebody who ministers, you have to get out of your comfort zone. My comfort zone is not up here on the stage. It's more comfortable than it used to be. I still get a little bit nervous, but I'm not sweating and freaking out and shaking physically before I got up here like I used to when I first did stuff like this. It's just obedience. You just step out of your comfort zone. Well, how do you do that? By faith. For a long time, I didn't understand how faith actually worked. I kind of see faith and obedience as the same thing. You just do that thing that you don't want to do. You feel like, oh, I can't, I don't know. And for me, even just 5-6 years ago, it was like going up to somebody that I didn't know and shaking their hand and saying hi. I don't know what it is. It doesn't make rational sense. We have fears all the time that don't make rational sense. Well, I could never be a part of the welcome team. I can't smile. I can't shake hands. I can't introduce myself. I don't like meeting people. Okay. Whatever it is, there are things that you are capable of that you don't realize yet. God always sees the potential in us. He doesn't see the lack in us. In Hebrews chapter 11, hopefully you've got your spot saved there. We're going to be back and forth to this place a couple of times. Moses' obedience here, and we've got a long list of stuff. Lots of people being obedient and faithful to the Lord. This is called the Hall of Faith. If you haven't read this, it'll get you going. It's an exciting chapter for sure. But in verse 23 through 29, I'm not going to read all of it. We read all about what Moses did in his faith. Over and over and over again, the miracles that he saw, the things that he led his people in. God used his obedience because he was willing to get outside of his comfort zone. And I want you guys to do that too, because I've seen it happen and I've seen what God does in it. Now, when you get outside your comfort zone, if you decide to be a part of the different teams that are available here, you're going to have to be filled up. I don't want to go beyond this. When you make that transition from receiver to giver to transformed, you've got to be filled up all the time and ready to give out. But can I just say that it's easier now than it's ever been to fill up with the Lord? It's so easy. If you don't have time, if you don't like reading, you can let the Bible read to you on your phone. You don't even have to read it. You can listen to it. The worship, the podcast, the things that are available to you, it's and you just have to hit a button and drive on down the road. I spend so much time with the Lord on the road. It's the easiest thing ever to show up somewhere ready and filled up with the Lord, because it's got it just playing through the speakers in my car. But you got to be filled up. In verse 32 of Hebrews 11 there, we see a few more people. A few more people here. It says, how much more do I need to say? He's going on and on about a bunch of different people. It would take too long to recount the stories of faith, of the faith of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and all the prophets. Well, if you haven't read much of the Old Testament, you're going to have a hard time feeling all those names. And this morning, I wanted to pick out a few of the obscure ones there that you don't read about too often, and I wanted to go over them. firstly, let's look at Barak. Barak. Judges chapter 4. I'm tempted to make a joke right now, but I'm not going to do it. Barak. Now, in Judges, this is before there were kings. This was God sent people to judge Israel, to make decisions of what's going on. Sometimes the judges were warriors, sometimes they were prophets, sometimes they were just people that sat in judgment and people brought their questions to them. And actually, chapter 4, if you'll notice the title at the top, it has nothing to do with Barak. What's it say? Deborah. Deborah is with Barak. And it says that the Lord turned, it said, this is how almost every chapter, every other chapter in Judges starts. After Ehud's death, Ehud was the judge before, the Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight. I can't tell you how many times that's written in the book of Judges. They again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So parents, there's hope. Again, we did the same thing again. But we'll get it turned around here eventually. So the Lord turned them over to King Jabin of Hazor, a Canaanite king, and the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Haggoyim. Sure. Sisera, who had 900 chariots, ruthlessly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, and then the people of Israel cried out for help to the Lord. Now, I don't know why it took them 20 years to cry out for help for the Lord. Like, the first time a bunch of 900 chariots come, I don't know what abused or ruthlessly oppressed. Our capacity to put up with junk in our life makes no sense to me. I don't know why we let, I've been suffering with this for a while. I've been having this for, I don't know. We have some weird issue in that we put up with the wrong kind of stuff for way too long. But that ruthlessly oppressed for 20 years, and then they cried out for help to the Lord. And verse 4, Deborah, the wife of Lapidoth, was a prophet who was judging Israel at the time. And she would send under the palm of Deborah, apparently she'd been sitting there for a while, between Ramah and Bethel, in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites would go to her for judgment. And one day she sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, who lived in Kadesh in the land of Naphtali. She said to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. Call out 10,000 warriors from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun at Mount Tabor, and I will call out Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, along with his chariots and warriors to the Kishon River. There, I will give you victory over him." So Deborah's commission here is, all right, you get 10,000 people together, and you go fight this guy, and the Lord's going to call out this guy that's been oppressing us for 20 years, and we're gonna do battle. And Barak's statement here is very interesting. He said, "I will go, but only if you go with me. I will go, but only if you go with me." Now, this chapter right in here is kind of like a girl power chapter, or can be read that way a little bit. He's willing to go, but only if she goes with him. And that's, as a man, that's kind of a sissy statement, honestly. You know, I mean, I'll go fight, but only if you, the woman, come with me. And just old stereotypes. But she says, "Very well, I will go with you, but you will receive no honor in this venture, for the Lord's victory over Sisera will be at the hands of a woman." You see why I say it's kind of a girl power chapter here. This chapter is good, and it's worth reading the rest of it, but here's the thing that I want to point out, because I see lessons and little tidbits all the time. Here's the deal. Whose name did we read in Hebrews 11? Hebrews 11? Barak. Deborah wasn't mentioned. It was Barak. I don't know if it was because of his name or because, I don't know what the deal was there, but he was obedient and he went out and he fought and he got a big victory. Here's my second lesson. It's okay to want help. It's okay to ask for other people to go with you. There is power in agreement. Many hands make light work. That's why we have a welcome team, not a welcome person. That's why we have multiple classes to go to. That's why we have multiple people in security. You're not alone. The second lesson is there's power in agreement. You're not alone. You're not by yourself. If you haven't joined up because you're worried about it, well, I don't know anybody here. Well, have you gone out to lunch with anybody after church? Get to know somebody. There's power in agreement. There's no shame in asking someone to help you. There are lots of times and lots of stories that you can think of, especially I think women have this down a whole lot better than men do, honestly. It's kind of funny that Brock asked for help, because most men are not going to ask for help with anything. They're only going to do it like, you really should have another person helping you lift that, but no, I'm going to get it. I'm going to figure out a way to do it on my own, by myself. Women ask for help with everything. Like, I want to go to the bathroom. You want to go with me? It doesn't make sense. They'll ask for help. There's no shame in nothing. They're just, it doesn't make sense. But it's not a matter of who or how many or what. It's a matter of we are all part of the same body here. As we're ministering, as we're sharing the gospel, as we're being a light in this world, you're not alone. And there's no shame in asking for help in what you're doing. In fact, it's easier when you have other people. It's easier to get up here and preach when Chapman gets up here and says, I've been thinking about you for days. I've been praying for you. I've been looking forward to this. That makes it easier. And that's who we are as a church. There's power in agreement. You remember back to when you were first learning to ride a bike? There's some of you maybe that you still don't know how to ride a bike, but it's okay. Just imagine that for this example here. Remember how nervous you were? Freaked out you are? Maybe as a parent, you remember helping your kid? There were actually dozens of you roller skating last Sunday. That nervousness that I thought about when you first ride a bicycle, there was a lot of you who were, it was like this all the way around the rink. And it was... Just, I am afraid I'm going to fall when I've learned a lot of things can be solved with just confidence. Now, there's a lot of bad things that can happen with confidence too. And there were some of you that were like, no, I'm going to do this. And you're just, right on the ground. And it was, but that nervousness when you first step out, it doesn't have to be there. You just have to put your faith in where you're at, what God's called you to do, who he's called you to be, and hanging out and roller skating was something for us all to have fun and laugh at. At one point, Melanie was out there. She'd given up on the skates, and she was out there in her socks. And she's just having fun in front of everybody, pretending to skate around in her socks. And it was the funniest thing. We are not alone. We're not here by ourselves. And the more that we talk to each other, the more that we get involved in what the church has going on, the better this life gets, the more enjoyable it is. All right, flip over to Judges chapter 11. We're going to go to another obscure one here. Judges 11. Jephthah was mentioned in there. And there's when you read the Old Testament, you realize that they reused names quite a lot and changed up just one letter here and one letter there. And Jephthah is specifically out of Judges 11 here. And again, Israel did what was wrong, evil in the sight of the Lord. And some different nations had come in here. And the Ammonites had come in and they were going to fight and knock people out and told them, hey, you stole our land. This is after they're in the promised land. And you stole our land. We're going to come and fight you and take it back. And Jephthah here, if you haven't read this one, you probably, it's not real well known, but it says Jephthah of Gilead was a great warrior. He was a son of Gilead, but his mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife also had several other sons, and when these half-brothers grew up, they chased Jephthah off the land. So you won't get any of our father's inheritance, they said, for you are the son of a prostitute. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. Soon he had a band of worthless rebels following him. Jephthah. Jephthah had some real issues in his life. He had some real bad history. He had some real big weaknesses. He made a really rash vow to the Lord. But what I'm trying to say is in this example of Jephthah, Jephthah had baggage. He was flawed. He was flawed in the eyes of other people. He was flawed to himself. He didn't have it all together. He was run off. He made some really dumb decisions. But we read about Jephthah in chapter 11 along with David and Samuel and Abraham and Moses. We read about Jephthah. The third lesson is this. Don't allow your mistakes or your weaknesses to define you. Don't allow your mistakes or your weaknesses to define you. If you have kids, you're called to be a parent. They're your first and most important disciples. And your mistakes, your lack of parents that you had when you were growing up, your lack of knowledge in what to do, your lack of, well, I don't know how to love very good, I don't know how to speak very well. None of that can define us as parents because we have a calling as making disciples of our kids. In this church, I don't look at anybody in this church as their worst mistake. I don't know most people's worst mistakes. Thankfully, nobody knows mine. There are people that we can share our life with, and we can support one another because we're not defined. As Christians, the best thing about Christianity is we're not defined by what we've done wrong, by what we can't do. We are defined by what He did. We are defined by what Jesus made possible in our life. We could all stand up here on stage and talk for hours about all the things we've done wrong in our life. Some of us woke up this morning in a bad attitude. Some of you don't want to be here. Some of you yelled at your family this morning. Many of us have stolen or lied. We could go on and on, but the amazing thing about the gospel is that the life-changing power of Jesus does not define us by what we can't do. It already says, no, you can't do anything. Therefore, I did something. That's the whole point. We are no longer defined by who we were. Well, I'm still making mistakes. That's all right. Too many Christians let their mistakes determine their ministry. I can't minister because I've done this wrong. I can't minister because I've done that wrong. They couldn't use me. I'm not perfect. Nobody is. Nobody is. There is not one perfect person in this room. God used Jephthah. God used Samson. Cool. Crazy. Crazy, goofy story of just some ridiculous stuff. God used Samson. God used David. We make a big deal out of King David and how awesome he was and how he had a heart after God. He was a murderer, an adulterer. By the world's standards today, if we were tearing people down for what they've done wrong, he'd be at the top of the list. God didn't see him that way. God used Rahab. She's called out in Hebrews 11. God used Aaron. God used Moses. He used Saul. He used the other Saul, whose name was changed to Paul. He used Peter. God uses flawed people because that's all he has to work with. The sooner we realize that we don't have to be flawless for God to use us, the sooner we'll get used. I'm not saying that you don't change and you don't grow. I'm saying that God will use you right where you're at. Don't let your mistakes define you. Don't let your weaknesses define you. And I want to end with our final lesson here. Somebody that's not mentioned in the Hall of Faith, but is important person. 2 Kings chapter 5. Another little bit more obscure one. 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 4. I'm going to talk to you about Naaman. Another valiant warrior, another mighty warrior, captain. But he was a leper. Leprosy is something that we don't really know too much about here personally in this country. But it was an awful skin disease, and it was very contagious, and you had to stay away from people. And honestly, if you came into, I guess when I think of lepers, the thing that comes up to me is when I was a kid, we watched Ben-Hur quite a few times. I don't know if anybody remembers that old movie or has spent 4 hours of your life watching it before. It's a good movie, but at one point, his mother and his sister get leprosy, and you're basically, you're completely shunned when you're a leper. You, if you come within any proximity of anybody, they'll start throwing rocks at you and chasing you off because they don't want to spread the leprosy. Well, I don't know how he got to be a valiant warrior and a leper. I don't know if he's like wiping his arms on the guys that he was fighting and they were freaking out or what. I don't know how that works together, but he wanted to be cured of his leprosy. And in verse 4 it says, so Naaman told the king what the young girl had said. The young girl came, let's go one verse before it. One day the girl said to her mistress, I wish my master would go and see a prophet in Samaria. He would heal him of his leprosy. Now they're talking about Elisha here. And so Naaman told the king what the young girl of Israel said. And he said, go visit the prophet, the king of Aram told him. I will send a letter of introduction for you and take to take to the king of Israel. So Naaman started out carrying his gifts of 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. And that's just crazy to me that we measure gold and silver in pounds there. They didn't back then, but that's a lot of metal. The letter to the king of Israel said, with this letter, I present my servant Naaman. I want you to heal him of his leprosy. If you haven't read this story recently, we don't have time to read the whole thing, but he goes there to see Elisha. And Elisha doesn't even come out to see him. He sends his servant out to him. He says, all right, Naaman. Servant comes out. All right, Naaman, you can go out and go to the Jordan River and wash yourself in it 7 times and you'll be healed. And the servant went back in and Naaman was just mad. He was frustrated. I came all this way. Imagine, because back then it wasn't hop in a car and drive up to Kansas City and come back like we did just in a day and a half there. It was, I mean, we got to saddle up everything. We got to get, I don't know what it takes to carry 750 pounds of silver and 150 pounds of gold and 10 outfits. I don't know what you, I mean, the outfits probably had to be stored a certain way because otherwise it's going to get all dusty on the thing. There's not enclosed anything. This is an undertaking to go up and see this guy. And he shows up and the servant comes out. Yeah, go wash in the Jordan and then come back. And he was so mad and so frustrated. And his servants said, hey, if the prophet had told you to do something really, really difficult, you would have done everything you could to make that happen. Just because of this trivial thing, you shouldn't not do what he says. I mean, might as well at least try it. He's like, yeah, we got better rivers over by us. Why wouldn't I just do that? Like, okay, but just do what he says. And so he does. He dips himself in the water 7 times. And it's crazy that it's 7 times because you know after the first time he was frustrated. He's like, this isn't working. And second time, third time. Okay, how many times is that? Was that 7? No, that's only 6. Whatever, it's not going to work the next time either. This is pointless. 7 times, and his skin, it says, was clean and clear as a newborn's skin. It's crazy. So he goes back and he says, truly you serve the Lord. And Naaman worships the Lord for the rest of his life, wholeheartedly. What's my fourth and final lesson here? With God, there is power in trivial things. The things we're talking about you doing in this church seem very trivial. I mean, how much is it to really say good morning? How much is it really to say, hey, park over here? How much is it really to stand around looking and making sure the place is safe? How much is it, like, when you think about it's very trivial. But I want to illustrate this point with a short story here, a personal story from my life. And this story ties directly into this point of, with God, there's power in trivial things. Because somebody went up to a window and knocked on the window and said, hi, won't you come on in? When I was about 8 years old, me and my younger sister got taken by our mom to get dropped off at the farm right up here in Greenfield, Missouri. and we loved going to the farm. But my mom, she was dropping us off the farm to leave us for good. She was done. She was fed up. She didn't want to have anything more to do with it. She just, I don't want to have anything to do with any of this life. And she drove down to Dallas to meet up with some old friends and do stuff that she didn't need to be doing. And she got down there, and nobody was available to talk or meet up or do anything. Nobody, not a single person. She had multiple people there, and nobody was available. And she ended up driving around Dallas and ended up in a parking lot somewhere. And in this parking lot was actually she's arguing with the Lord this whole time. She'd grown up in church. She knew who the Lord was. She understood how things were supposed to be, but she was just mad and running away from what she knew was right. And she said, she knew, sitting in this parking lot here, that the name Jesse Duplantis meant a God conference of some sort. And she was just sitting there arguing with the Lord. I'm not doing this. This is the dumbest thing. I don't even know why I'm here. Why did I even come? I came to find all these different, I don't understand any of this. And along comes a little old lady. Hi, I'm so glad you're here. Knocking on her window, just being annoying. It would have been annoying to me. Hi. When I'm sitting in my car and I have the windows up, I don't want to talk to anybody. It's not an open invitation to come see. But this woman didn't care. Hi, I'm so glad you're here. Won't you come on in? Let me get you out and walks her in, marches her right up to the front row, sits down on the front row of this conference, and preacher begins preaching about the seeds that you plant and the harvest that they'll produce, and she starts falling apart and breaking apart and saying, okay, God, if I'm going to do this, it better be real. It better be the real deal, because if it's not, and she gave her heart to the Lord. And she came back and picked us up from the farm. We didn't know any better. I heard this story when I was 23 years old. Day before I was getting married. God took something very trivial and did a lot with it. And if you think back over your personal life, it has been the person that welcomes you, that hugs you, that hands you your coffee, that knows just the way you like it, that you see on a regular, it's the trivial things that matter. When people get up, when we have people get up here, young people graduating, very often they'll mention the people that had them over to eat a meal. I ate at your house. What's the big, eating is a big deal. Especially to young people, especially to young men. Eating is a big deal. It's the trivial things that matter. It's the things that don't seem important, that there's power in that. God can take those moments and use them in a big way. Well, I'm just gonna make coffee. Yeah. I'm just gonna make coffee. The whole reason we have it out there is so that people have a reason to stand around and talk and get connected. Somebody's got to make it. And there's connection that's happened there. How many great conversations have happened in this church just in the last, 3 years now that we've been doing this? How many great God conversations have happened encouraging just because of coffee? Coffee. I'm going to sit in here and in this nursery, and we got these kids. These kids aren't—they're just running all over the place. And they love the people that watch them more than anything, and they love the situation that it's. I remember so many things growing up. Like I talked about the men that did kids' church with me. I wanted to be just like them. There is nothing trivial with God. He uses it all, and He uses it all in a powerful way. So, as I close today, I want to say that if you're not involved in this church in a big way, I want to encourage you to be. I want you to go out, and at the Welcome Center out there, I want you to sign up for one of these areas, because we are saved so that we can get other people saved. We are discipled so that we can get other people discipled. We are blessed to be a blessing. That's the whole purpose of us being a church body. And there are two ways to encourage and build up the church. You can encourage and build up the people that are physically here, and you can encourage other people to come here to be built up. But we are the body of Christ. We are his hands and feet. We're the ones that are to do all of these things. And we can't let these things stop us from serving him. So I want to encourage you to do your part. If you are already signed up and you're already doing this, is for some of you, you are overdoers and you already serve in three different areas and you're thinking, oh, I really need to do one more. That's not who I'm talking to right now. Okay? Talking about people who are not sure if they can, not sure if God could use them. He can. He can use anybody. He can use anybody. I'm up here. I should not be up here. God can use anybody. But as we close today, I want you to leave going out by the Welcome Center and making an effort to get outside your comfort zone. I want you to know that there's power in agreement. I don't want you to let your past mistakes or weaknesses define you. And I want you to remember that with God, the trivial becomes extraordinary. Amen.
We hope that you have been blessed, encouraged, and motivated by today's message. If you are interested in more messages by Christian Ministries Church, then log on to our website at www.cmchurch.net and click on the podcast link.